Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Coming up, as the US government threatens to break up Google, a former company executive gives his take.
This is probably the biggest government intervention in big tech that we've seen, certainly that I can remember. A lot of governments will be looking at this saying, okay, that's an interesting precedent. What do I not like about what the big tech companies do?
And we'll be looking back on the life of one of India's most famous businessmen, Ratan Tata, who has passed away in Mumbai in the last few hours. But we're going to start the programme in Florida, where several million people have been told to evacuate ahead of the arrival of the latest storm, which is expected to make landfall on Wednesday night. So not too long to go there. As well as powerful winds, it could bring a storm surge of more than 4 meters. That, of course, is Hurricane Milton. The city's mayor in Sarasota, south of Tampa, is one of the areas where people are being moved. Liz Albert has been speaking to the BBC.
This is very different than anything that we have seen. And then when you combine that much storm surge with 155-mile-an-hour winds and then rain on top of that, it's going to be really, really devastating. So I'm hoping everybody will hang in there and we'll all help each other on the other side.
Many residents have moved to shelters, but some are choosing to stay in their homes. Steve Harris has chosen to remain in his house with his pregnant girlfriend tonight.
It's easy for someone to say that's not here. You know, I've had plenty of friends and family and people that know me. Get out. But it's easy to say that when you're not here. When you're here, you got to make those decisions and you got to hope that you're going to come back to something. And it just made it really tough. If we had our own financial backing, we would have been gone Monday, Sunday even. That's not the case. I just don't know if I can leave and then not be able to come back for a while. I'm being very thoughtful and maybe a little nervous.
Tough decisions for people. Let's hear from a business there who also has to make tough decisions. Jason Wadilla runs a cookie business in Tampa, Florida. He's traveled 4 hours away to Jacksonville to avoid the hurricane. Jason, thanks so much for joining us here on the program. And that is, I know people have been told to leave. That's a tough decision, isn't it, to leave your home and your business behind?
It is. It's very tough, particularly not knowing what I may return to and the damage that may ensue as a result of the storm. And if, in fact, I will be able to go back anytime soon and reopen.
That sounds like you think you may not be able to go back soon and reopen. Clearly, lives are the most important things, but economics, businesses are important. You must worry about the future there.
Of course, yes. We were forced to close most of this week. We were forced to close a couple of weeks ago in connection with Hurricane Helene, which resulted in rather devastating flooding in the areas where my businesses operate. And so, yes, each day that we're closed, we are not able to provide our staff their wages. They too have bills to pay. And then, of course, we're not able to generate revenue to pay our own bills.
Let's hope that the hurricane doesn't hit Tampa too hard. But if it does, and, you know, your business and your property faces problems, particularly the property involved here, how is your insurance situation? Because many people are worried about that, aren't they?
They are, of course. And so I have business insurance. There are certain provisions within the policy that do require a primary that require primary damage for secondary benefits to kick in. So, for example, the policy does provide for loss of revenue, but there must that's a secondary coverage. So I must have a primary coverage, for example, damage to the building that does not allow me to reopen before that kicks in. So the fact that I've had to close in advance of the storm, and then, for example, if we lose electricity for long periods of time before it's restored, I'll have to continue to remain closed. And the loss of electricity is not necessarily a covered peril for that secondary to kick in.
So briefly, if you don't mind, it's difficult, isn't it? You're not really sure how much your insurance may cover some of the problems you're about to face.
That is exactly right. So, for example, with Hurricane Helene, the primary coverage did not kick in. That covered from the roof down. There was no evidence of wind damage during Helene. The flood insurance covered from the slab up. We did have extensive flooding, yet the flood insurance is administered by the U.S. government's Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the coverage is substantially less than what the private insurance covers. For example, the contents cap is $25,000 with a $10,000 deductible. So as you can imagine, a few pieces of equipment far exceeds the value of what the cap of the personal property contents on flood insurance covers.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck. We'll keep in touch with you and see when you can reopen. Now, I want to bring in Kerry Leahy quickly here, economist at Columbia University. And we've seen this week, haven't we, some of those insurance stocks having a difficult time. This is going to be a difficult period for many people in Florida and also for those insurance companies.
Well, the numbers are extraordinary. If we go back and look at the biggest single hurricane before us was almost 20 years ago and cost $100 million. This was Hurricane Katrina. Now Milton might be $175 billion worth of damages. So it's quite extraordinary. That doesn't even include the cost of places like Western North Carolina, which are not areas you'd expect to have problems with hurricane-like storms, but they do, and just making it very difficult for a wide variety of terrains. And probably in the future, it'll be more expensive if you can even get insurance for residential and even business properties.
Let's pick up on that point that Kerry raised there with Christopher Flavelle on the whole insurance industry. He is the climate correspondent for the New York Times. Earlier this year, he co-authored an investigation into the possible collapse of America's home insurance system. I asked him firstly how big a deal this hurricane is.
From my part of the world, when I talk to federal officials who work in disaster response and recovery, they seem scared by this. They seem to feel that this storm will do so much damage to Florida that just the capacity to rebuild will be strained, which is saying a lot because the U.S. sadly has a lot of experience these days in rebuilding following disasters. But even people who've been through many big storms seem unusually concerned by what Milton means for Florida.
Okay, you talked about rebuilding. As part of that process, insurance is going to be critical. But whenever we speak to people in Florida, they are worried about their insurance, particularly the cost of it. Give us an idea of what's been happening in the U.S. with home insurance.
This storm and this year's storm season are coming at a really tough time for the insurance market across the U.S. and in Florida in particular. We've had a series of years with really bad disasters. And what that means is home insurers around the country have really struggled to continue making money. Our own reporting from earlier this year shows that in a lot of states around the U.S., home insurers are losing significant money on their business. In places like Florida, that's especially far advanced. In Florida, insurers have really struggled just to break even. So this storm could certainly, in Florida, could threaten the viability of individual Florida insurance companies. But even around the country, right? This is an industry that is already off balance and could, you know, I don't want to make predictions, but like this will be a big deal for the U.S. home insurance industry.
I was looking at some of the figures that you had put out there. Between 2020 and 2023, the price of insuring a home in the U.S. jumped 33% because we're seeing so much change in the climate, is it important that insurance is regulated? Because otherwise, those increases seem to be different in different areas.
So insurance is regulated at the state level in the U.S., and there's different degrees of oversight. Some places like California have been very aggressive in trying to prevent or slow the rate of increase in insurance.
Is that what is needed?
There's no quick answer. Experts will tell you it's a mix of better resilience measures in terms of infrastructure and changing how we build homes, maybe being more thoughtful in where we build homes, certainly changing how we recover after storms to make neighborhoods more resilient in the face of storms, probably changing the pricing structure so people at least are exposed to more information and they can make a decision based on something. When they buy a home, they can know the risk they face. But even if you get all those things right, it's unclear to what degree insurance by itself can help sort of the American home industry and Americans in general deal with climate change, because the shock is so big.
Final question to you. Whoever we speak to in Florida at the moment, their number one concern is to protect their lives. After that, it is to make sure that after Storm Milton, that they can economically rebuild their lives. Will there be people, because of the problems in the insurance sector, for whom that's going to be difficult?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to overstate how much of an economic headwind it is right now in Florida with rising insurance rates. This storm will only make it worse. I think really calling into question just what the makeup is of the kind of people who can afford to live in Florida as these storms get worse.
We will, of course, keep across events in Florida here on the BBC World Service. Now, the plane maker Boeing has withdrawn its offer of a 30% pay rise to tens of thousands of striking workers in the US. The company and the unions, well, they blame each other for the collapse of the talks. I've been speaking to John Holden. He's the president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. They're negotiating with Boeing at the moment at the IAM District 751.
We're bargaining to try and reach a resolution, and this is the third time that Boeing has broke off mediated talks, and I guess it's not unexpected, but, you know, we're putting in the work. We're ready to negotiate the items that our members tell us are important.
Can I put to you what Stephanie Pope said, Boeing's commercial airplanes chief executive? Unfortunately, the union did not seriously consider our proposals. Further negotiations do not make sense at this point.
Yeah, I mean, they made some slight movement that didn't address some of the major issues that we're trying to address. They didn't increase the general wage increases. They didn't address 401k match in any way. They didn't reinstate the pension. They didn't add any additional paid time off for work-life balance. You know, they did give us a minimum on the annual bonus, you know, of 2%. But over 11 out of the last 12 years, we've achieved greater than 2%. They did make a meager improvement in a retirement. We're trying to increase the multiplier for those that have a vested pension benefit, and they made a slight increase, but they didn't address any of those other issues. You know, what also struck me is that she said, we continue to propose items that are non-negotiable. I mean, the arrogance of an employer to say what is negotiable and what isn't. I mean, we're advocates for our members. We are, you know, sent by our members to address the issues they say are important.
A lot of people would look at a 30% pay offer and think, even though that's over 4 years, that is a decent offer.
These are some of the largest wage increases we've seen. The problem is it's coming off the worst contract we've ever had, and we were stagnated in our wages over a 10-year period. And, you know, during that period, we saw some of the highest inflation in our country over the last 40 years. We lost our defined benefit pension 10 years ago. We had a massive cost shift to cover our healthcare costs, and people are trying to make up for what they lost and then try to make up for the future and get a good increase so that they can participate in our economy.
Do you worry that as this strike drags on, that Boeing could take more extreme measures like laying off workers?
I get concerned if the company doesn't acknowledge that the only way out of their troubles, their struggles, is with the IAM. You know, we're the ones that build the airplanes. We're the ones that deliver the airplanes and bring the profit. Without us, there is no Boeing. And so it's time they realize that and stop making these missteps in the bargaining process.
From the conversation that we're having, clearly you're annoyed about what has happened here. How do you go back to negotiating when there doesn't seem to be trust between both sides here?
You know, like I said, our focus is, you know, meeting our members' demands, trying to address the issues they say are important. There's room to bargain here. That's what our goal is. That's why we've never walked away from the table. We're always willing to continue either direct or mediated discussions. And that's the only way through. On September 23rd, they dropped an offer on us that was not negotiated, and they immediately sent it to the press as a tactic to try and pressure our members. And it backfired on them. They sent an ultimatum that they immediately walked away from. The reality is there is room for a negotiated settlement. They just have to stay at the table. We got to continue pushing through it.
But it doesn't sound like you're going to be back at the table soon here.
I don't know when we'll be back at the table. Like I said, we're always willing. We'll now focus on, again, on running our strike and supporting our members and ensuring that we're supporting their needs as we go through this.
This is a company that is in trouble at the moment. I don't think there's any doubt about that, is there, Boeing, because of the safety problems that it is facing. Isn't it time that you and the management sit down, try and work this out? Both of you have to compromise here, because otherwise, one of the U.S.'s great manufacturing companies, its future looks bleak.
Yeah, I think on safety and quality, I believe we are aligned. You know, we made some good progress in that area. We have some tentative agreements from the original bargaining that I think will help serve us well, gives the IAM a seat at the table. It is definitely not a board seat, and that's okay. Our goal, though, was to be able to have discussions around changes to the manufacturing system, raise concerns, have them addressed, and try to make this a better company.
John Holden there, who's leading negotiations on behalf of the unions. Kerry Lee, he's still with us. The problem for Boeing here is that if this drags on, it's just costing the company more and more money, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And things seem to get worse rather than better. And even though this is an iconic company without a lot of competitors, and it has very strong regional impacts, it's just looking bleaker and bleaker until, as you said earlier, they can come to some compromise about quality, the ability to deliver, and come up with a total wage bill that both sides can live with, and they haven't gotten there yet.
No, they haven't. We have a statement from Boeing. It's a long one. We'll give you a bit of it here. This is disappointing in terms of an outcome, not one we wanted. We remain committed to finding a resolution, and we will work with the union when they are ready to bargain an agreement. You're with World Business Report here from the BBC World Service.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Let us talk about another great American company. Alphabet, of course, owns the huge search giant Google. They've been told by the U.S. Department of Justice that they have to radically change their business model. Otherwise, they could be broken up. Ben Legg used to be Google's chief operating officer in Europe. He's now a tech entrepreneur.
This is probably the biggest government intervention in big tech that we've seen, certainly that I can remember. A lot of governments will be looking at this saying, okay, that's an interesting precedent. What do I not like about what the big tech companies do?
Let's pick up on some of the points that Ben raised there. I've been speaking to Rebecca Hoare-Allensworth. She's professor at Vanderbilt Law School in Nashville, Tennessee. So how likely is it that Google could be broken up?
I think that the likelihood that it will happen as a result of this search case that the government won earlier in the summer, the answer to that question is virtually zero. There's almost no chance that the court is going to break up Google in the search monopolization case. The government yesterday filed a set of requests that sort of hint at and maybe explore the idea of asking for a breakup. I don't even think we know that they're going to ask for it for sure. But I think if they do, the court's not going to grant it. There's another case going against Google right now, though, the ad tech case, for which a breakup, I think, is more likely if there's a liability found in that case.
If we just break this down simply, if the government did want to break up Google, for our listeners, why would they want to break up Google?
In the case of the search monopolization case, they would want to break up Google because Google controls a couple of different outlets for its search product, basically the Android ecosystem and Chrome. And the heart of that case is that Google is making sure that its search product is the only one, it's the default on all ways of distributing search. The problem for the breakup idea, though, is that the biggest way that it distributes its search product is actually through Apple. And it's these massive payments for to be the exclusive default on iPhone that are really the heart of the case and that wouldn't have anything to do with a breakup. So to answer your question, the government wants to break up Google because it wants to reduce its control on the outlets through which search is distributed.
Is there a bit of the big stick here? You know, the government saying, we may break you up unless you start opening up when it comes to competition, which is obviously better for the consumers. And that seems to be a line that they're moving down.
I do think that there's some incentives that the government is trying to create for Google to voluntarily change its practices. And that's just how law works. You know, if the law, it says that what you're doing may be illegal, and of course that you have to have the enforcement behind that for it to matter, then firms are going to alter their behavior. I think another way of looking at this is they're asking for the moon from the court and hoping to get something in the middle. That's the way I see this sort of big stick problem.
They're not going to get the moon. Give us a
they're not going to get the
what are they going to get then?
Well, okay, so I think they're definitely going to get an injunction against the exclusive dealing contracts that are kind of the heart of the case. And I think a more interesting question is, will they also get an order that Google has to share some of the elements of search that competitors need to make a competitive search product? So, for example, the index that Google has is very valuable, and you need to know what you're searching in order to make a good search product. User data helps Google build a good search engine, and the algorithm itself. I think the court's very unlikely to force Google to share its algorithm, but I do think forcing it to share the index actually makes a lot of sense, and it's possible the court could go for that.
Rebecca Allensworth there. Kerry Leahy is still with us. Kerry, we've had the Fed minutes now. These are the minutes about the meetings that the Federal Reserve have before they make a decision on interest rate cuts. They're important. What are they telling us?
Well, it stated, and no surprise, that a majority of members wanted to do a 0.5% cut, but there were some members, some means probably as many as 5 of the total membership, who wanted to only go a 0.25%. So I think the market has made itself resigned to the fact that they're not going to do more than 0.25% in the next meeting. So I think this is putting yet another nail in the coffin that half a percentage point move or 50 basis points is out for the next meeting.
Okay, thanks for that, Kerry. In India, it's early in the morning, and all the TV channels there, well, they're running headlines like this one.
There's some big breaking news coming in. Ratan Tata has passed away. The announcement from Tata Group says it is with a profound sense of loss.
Yeah, Ratan Tata, the Indian industrialist and philanthropist who was chairman of Tata Sons for over 20 years, has died in Mumbai, aged 86. I lived in India for a long time. It is difficult to overstate his importance. Probably the most important business leader in the country since independence. Our India business correspondent in Mumbai has been looking back at his life. Here's Archana Shukla.
He was an icon. He was an industry icon. He was a philanthropist. He was a trade person who people looked up for, not only what he did in the industry, but also for his values. He was known as an avid investor. In fact, he ran the operations of the Tata Sons Group, which is one of the oldest business conglomerates in India, expanded the business beyond just a few businesses. You know, now they do from salt to steel to software, taking on big, giant brands globally. And he's known to have globalized the Tata Group.
He certainly has. Kerry, sometimes you have figures, don't you, that sort of dominate the business environment in a country. And that was Ratan Tata was. We've seen other examples, haven't we, globally as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he touched just about everything you can think of. He had hotels, he had steel, and the like. So it's impressive. And to me, it's nice to hear a billionaire actually be so much self-effacing, which is something that American-based billionaires seem to have a hard time figuring out.
Yeah, he was a very popular figure, seemed to be somebody that, you know, the general public doesn't often know much about businessmen, do they? But they, in India, there were a lot of people who had a lot of respect for Ratan Tata. Right. We are going to go back to our top story before we finish this programme, and that is an update on Hurricane Milton. 7 million people in Florida have been told to evacuate ahead of the arrival of the hurricane. Let's speak to one, Alan Archer, meteorologist at the Continental Weather Corporation, based normally in Tampa. Where have you got to now, Alan?
Well, I'm about 2 hours north of there because we had to evacuate because of the storm. And big problem is going to be loss of power. I mean, much of Central Florida, Tampa Bay, Orlando areas.
I think we have seen some of the problems there that people are facing in Florida at the moment. Alan Archer, we have lost him for this particular bit of time. We'll try and get him back. Let's go to Kerry Leahy once again. Kerry, we started the program, didn't we, trying to look at the problems that Hurricane Milton was going to create economically for Florida. And it's getting harder and harder for states to keep rebuilding after events like this, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Sadly, we've been talking about coastal properties for as long as I've been alive. And the question you continue to ask is how can you continue to rebuild and spend money without spending money at least more wisely and coming up with more ecologically sound approaches if you're even going to be near the coastline at all. But without some overall taxpayer support, it's very hard to think that people can actually come back and rebuild the way they did. And that itself, asking other people to pay for a coastal properties rebuilding and you're not anywhere near there, is a tough sell to a lot of people.
We got Alan back. Alan, thanks for rejoining us here. I know that you're trying to evacuate, but you're also keeping an eye on Hurricane Milton. What exactly is happening with it at the moment? Do we know if it's going to definitely hit Tampa?
Well, it's actually going to pass probably immediately south. I mean, like in the next few hours, it's going to move into an area about 15 miles, 20 miles south of Tampa that's known as Lombeau Key. Right now, those areas like Tampa, St. Petersburg, getting drenched with heavy rain and gusty winds, 50, 60 miles an hour. But the strongest part of the hurricane is going to be to the south. Areas like Bradenton, Sarasota, these are very populated areas as well. Touristy areas as well. And in those areas, they could see wind gusts of 100 miles an hour. Right now, it's a 120 mile an hour Category 3 hurricane.
We've got some pictures on our screen. We can see the trees blowing, you know, being bent by those winds in Florida at the moment. You have covered many different hurricanes. Is this one of the most dangerous hurricanes that you've seen, Alan?
At one time it was. It was 180 mile an hour sustained winds early yesterday, but no longer. Now at 120 miles an hour, it's a weaker storm, but still with the potential of producing big time damage as a wall of water rushes onto the West Coast beaches near the Sarasota Bradenton area. That's a 5 meter wall of water being pushed by the wind onto land. And those coastal communities, no doubt, can sustain a lot of devastation.
Alan, we're going to wish you all the luck as you continue to move as far away from Hurricane Milton as you can. Kerry Leahy, as always, thank you for your comments here on World Business Report. We'll be back with Business Matters in a couple of hours' time. We'll bring you the latest from Florida and also continue to look back on the life of Ratan Tata. But that is it for World Business Report.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.